Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
It's been a year since the Biden administration first called for agencies to ramp up in-person work back to the office. Well, now, after coming back to their offices, many feds, those that did, are asking, why are we here? Well, we asked too, and our Federal News Network survey found that more than half of feds don't think their agency leadership has really explained the return to office rationale. Federal News Network's Drew Friedman joins me now with more of those survey results. And let's begin with some of the stats here. Drew, how many responses did we get?
Tom, we received more than 6,300 responses on this survey. That is huge. It's almost 2,000 more than any survey that Federal News Network has conducted. And I would say before we even get into the survey results, just that sheer number of responses tells you how important of a subject this is to federal employees. Whether or not you agree with returning to the office, whether or not you agree that you want to be teleworking or whether you want to be in person, it's a huge topic, and it's been that way for several years now.
Yeah, it's the biggest thing since pay and benefits. I guess maybe it's a benefit. And based on the survey results, 6,300, wow, what are some of the common concerns about the return to the office?
Some of the common points that a lot of federal employees in the survey brought up, they talked about their ability to focus. I think that was a big one. So they said distractions or disruptions from coworkers, or exhaustion from the commute, trying to get to and from the office every day. Those all contribute negatively or adversely to their productivity. They find, as you said, they don't really understand why they're in the office. A lot of agencies have pointed to stronger collaboration, productivity, efficiency, better work culture, all of these factors that go into why federal employees are coming back to the office. But it's either feds don't believe those are the reasons, or they disagree that those are really specific to being in the office. We found that from the survey results, two-thirds of respondents felt they were less productive in the office, and a lot of them believed that senior leadership isn't really explaining in enough rationale for why
right. They're
there.
Yeah. We just want to hear because Jeff Zients said to be here because the White House told him to say you need to be here. And mm-hmm. The annoyance with the other colleagues and the distractions. I mean, let's face it, when you're home, nobody is having anchovy pizza, you know, when the anchovies were soaked in garlic oil or something. And one of the big issues of the federal, any office space, I guess. And we know that some of the agencies want to encourage their offices as collaboration spaces. You can rent spaces to get together, reserve spaces, I should say. What about that? Does that go over pretty well?
Not exactly. I think, well, just to point out what agencies are trying to do, a lot of them have introduced what they call core collaboration days, which is, in so many words, it's government speak for, you know, we're going to bring employees in person on the same day at the same time and set up meetings or specific activities that foster collaboration or are meaningful in-person work. A lot of federal employees in this survey said they were a bit neutral, I suppose, on whether or not those were beneficial to their productivity. About half said that they don't really affect their like work-related tasks or their interpersonal relationships with coworkers, and to some extent had a negative impact on both productivity and just overall office morale.
Yeah, my theory on that is that there are times when formal collaboration has to happen. Say, let's do our strategic plan for the year or something, and everyone's prepared in advance, and you go and do your strategic collaborating. Then there are those infinite number of last minute, spur of the moment, oh, I see that person, let me collaborate type of thing. That doesn't happen at all when everyone's teleworking, or maybe it happens and you reach them by some sort of communications means, Slack or whatever the case might be. Not quite the same thing. So the idea of everyone coming in at a given day seems forced because, oh, here, let's collaborate because we're all here. There may be nothing to collaborate about at that moment. But the next morning at 10:30, when everyone's back at home, that's when the need arises. So that could be the answer to why that answer came up so much in the survey.
No, that I think that you pretty much nailed it, Tom. There, you know, a lot of respondents to the survey said that, you know, it should be up to them to decide when and where that collaboration is needed. And they said a lot of the times those meetings don't really have to be in person. They can be, like you said, over Slack, Zoom, Teams, whatever means you have it. And they said, you know, the workplace is shifting, it's adapting, and they don't really understand, or a lot of people don't understand why they're going back to the office more often.
And we have been covering agency by agency the specific policies. And for some agencies, a lot of the bigger agencies, there's a minimum number of days or that you have to be there. And it's not even five. It might be four or so out of the pay period, which is 2 to 3 days per work. But it sounds like even that's not going over very well.
It really depends on the agency. Yes, it is going to be about 50% of your work hours spent in the office for those who have initiated those return to office plans. I think what federal employees in this survey are getting at, more so than how many days or the number of days in the office that they're spending, it's more a question of just they want more flexibility. They want to be able to decide when they're going to the office and how much, and to only go in when it makes sense rather than being told, hey, you have to be in every Wednesday, for example.
And one of the things that the survey showed is that people are having maybe negative views of agency leadership over this issue, because leadership, management, SES, and the political appointees are kind of obligated to carry out what the White House wants, or at least try to.
Yes, some of the survey questions that we did for the survey were looking at how return-to-office plans affected views of immediate supervisors, senior leaders, and then overall agency. It's clear that a lot of federal employees, not super surprisingly, place more of the blame or the onus on the return-to-office plans on senior leadership. And we had 47% of respondents said that they now feel more negatively towards senior leaders as a result of return to office changes, and about similar results for just their views of the agency overall. So this is having a more long-term impact on federal employees and how they're seeing their day-to-day work.
And as you know, and as we were covering for 15 years prior to this, telework was not a birth effect of the pandemic. There was telework policy, there were telework debates, telework bills. Some agencies had gone fully to telework or extensively to telework because they had a scattered workforce. PTO was the brainchild of that for so many years. So has there been a shift in telework because of the pandemic? I mean, what did that change? If nothing, then get everyone to mass telework and everyone got a taste of it.
No, it's a really good question. Telework has been around, as you said. It's well predates the pandemic. And I think one big takeaway from the survey was federal employees, a majority of them feel like telework is beneficial and productive, and they don't really understand why you would want to shift back to what they had before the pandemic if they feel like, you know, this was a lesson we learned during the pandemic, even though, of course, there was a lot of negative news and things that came from the pandemic. One positive was understanding the importance of hybrid work and having that flexibility. And I think you just have a lot of federal employees who feel happy with those changes and they want to stick with them.
Well, productivity is a hard thing to measure in this type of, let's say, for lack of a better word, white-collar workforce. And a person might think they're more productive, but that's not necessarily the case.
No, that's a great question as well. A lot of agencies have different ways to measure productivity. Some, it's easier. You can look at the number of documents that were completed or whatever you want to say, like a number of cases that were resolved. There are some number involved, but a lot of federal employees have work where you can't really measure that in a number. And that is a question that definitely has come up in Congress, in the White House, and I think will continue to come up for a long time.
Federal News Network's Drew Friedman, thanks so much.
Thanks, Tom.
And be sure to check out her survey story. It was her survey at federalnewsnetwork.com.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected, and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important, so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective. We get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down. So I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you've piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned, or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work, and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is what do they need when they need it, and building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor. And I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions. And that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion, and then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there, taking notes on the meeting, and said, go ahead, and I want to hear from you. And I realized in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way, and I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that, I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped. And I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture and what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful. So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with a intentional focus on culture. Because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going. Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure, either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career. And that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been married, happily married for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. You're, Thank you. Having known you now for 7 or 8 years and worked alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.